watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
this week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. In the book Forgiving, a feminist critique of exchange that I've been reading from over recent weeks, philosopher Genevieve Vaughn has made the case that understanding how the dehumanization of women under patriarchy is key to understanding other coercive or exploitative social arrangements based on maintaining authority and privilege by force and violence. Vaughn notes that the privileged ones are distinguished by a mark. In the case of patriarchy, a body part and a gender identity. In the case of other analogous systems of domination and submission, the mark may be skin color, ownership of property, membership in an ideological or ethnic group, or the wearing of special clothes like uniforms and badges. Though I'm going to suspend the reading of Vaughn's book this week on account of time constraints, it nonetheless provides a useful frame for understanding the topic of this week's program, torture, and why it persists even in societies that officially reject its use. When an incident of torture or brutality by the military or police erupts into public view as a scandal, the official opinion makers repeatedly frame the incident as a result of individual flaws, bad apples. Our speakers on this week's program will provide a different perspective that exposes the roots of torture as a crime of obedience, in conformity to a society where bullies rule. Or to put it another way, why would one be surprised at the brutal conduct of U.S. soldiers engaged in an invasion and occupation whose purpose is the domination and exploitation of another people by force and violence, the brainchild of bullies, supported by a culture of bullying, propagandized by a media of loudmouth bullies and craven conformists who call themselves the free and the brave? We'll begin with a social psychologist who's devoted decades of research to the explanation of such atrocities and who spoke on his most recent findings laid out in his new book called The Lucifer Effect. He's Professor Philip Zimbardo, and this talk was given in October as part of the Authors Series at the Google Corporation.
Professor Philip Zimbardo from Stanford University has been a researcher and a teacher in psychology for the last 50 years. And more than that, he's really been the public face of social psychology for most of that time through his tenureship as president of the American Psychological Association and his many lectures and books trying to bring psychology to the masses, and really been an advocate for his strong belief that social psychology can provide a lot of the answers that help make this world a better place. And in that light, Phil has just finished a book, The Lucifer Effect, and be happy to chat about with that today. So without further ado, Dr. Z.
It's great to be here. What I want to do today is talk about some research I've been doing for many, many years that was filed away and suddenly got to be relevant with the events happening in Abu Ghraib a few years ago. But I want to set the context for this, what I'm going to present today, the psychology of evil. The question of what makes people go wrong, why do good people do bad things, this is a question that theologians have faced, historians, dramatists, poets, psychologists have tended to ignore those big questions. We tend to have really precise answers to really small questions because we have really good techniques of assessment, experimental design. But my training was both as a psychologist, sociologist, anthropologist. So sociologists ask big questions. They never have an answer because they don't have very good methodology. So my whole career has been, how do you ask big questions and use the right methodology for answering them? So this is what I've been tackling of late. How do we understand evil? Back in a couple of years ago, all of you saw the same images that I saw on April 28th, TV expose of horrific images. Inexcusable behavior by anybody, but they were not inexplicable. When I saw those, there were direct visual parallels to the study I did at Stanford 35 years ago, very similar to images that I'm going to show you later on. So when the Bush administration and the military immediately said, this is the work of a few bad apples, a few rogue soldiers, it is not systemic, I knew that was probably a lie. Anyway, I entertained the hypothesis. Maybe our soldiers were really good to begin with, and maybe they were not bad apples until they were corrupted by being put in a bad barrel. And if so, then I also wanted to understand who made that bad barrel. How do you get data to answer that kind of hypothesis? Well, you'd have to be an investigative reporter. You have to get access to some of those soldiers, access to that situation in order to answer it. Well, I actually became an expert witness for one of the guards, Sergeant Chip Frederick, who was the guard who was supposed to be in charge of that night shift. And so I got to know everything there is to know about this man, about his family, about the other soldiers. And then because I was an expert witness, I had access to all the images. What we have seen is 24 that the military has effectively suppressed viewing the others, and there are more than 1,000. Many of those more horrible than what we've seen, and I'm going to show you some of those. But I also had access to all of the investigative reports. There are 12 of them, and they run 200 to 300 pages. I doubt anybody's read them but me. But as a teacher, scholar, and to do a good job as an expert witness, I read all of those reports, and they are enlightening. And so I'm now in a position to answer the question, were these a few bad apples, or was it the barrel that was bad? I want to start with this wonderful image from M.C. Escher. And if you look at it, some of you will immediately focus on the black and make the white the background. Some of you will focus on the white and make the black the background. But if you look more closely, what you see is a world either filled with angels, little tutus, or a world filled with demons or devils. So you make the white the figure and the black the background, it's a world full of goodness. If you focus on the black, make that the figure and the white the background, then it's a world full of devils. So this tells me several things. It tells me the world is, has always been, and probably will always be filled with both good and evil. It reminds me also that God's favorite angel, according to some ancient scripture, was Lucifer. Lucifer, if you remember, became the devil. So this is the most extreme transformation imaginable. And the story goes something like, when God created Adam, his perfect creature, he told the angels that they must bow down and honor Adam. And Lucifer and some other angels said, doesn't make sense. He's immortal, we're angels. We were here prior to him. Even though Lucifer was supposedly God's favorite son, called the morning star, favorite angel, God was not into conflict resolution, that God of that time. And instead, he got Michael, the archangel, to come, and with other angels, there was this cosmic battle in heaven, and Michael won and Lucifer lost. And paradoxically, it was God who created hell as a place to put the fallen angels. And the reason God was upset is Lucifer committed two sins, the sin of disobedience to the highest authority and the sin of pride. And those continue to be sins that people get punished for. The focus on individuals who are good or bad was really highlighted back in the Middle Ages in the Inquisition. In 22 Catholic countries throughout the world, people identified as witches by people in the town, anyway, were tortured, made to confess, and then killed. It all began with this book, which I recommend to you, paperback, the Malleus Maleficarum. It's called The Witch's Hammer, written in 1486 by two German theologians, Heinrich Kramer and James Springer. And they raise an interesting conundrum. How could evil exist in a world governed, created by an all-powerful, all-loving God? You know, God should say, no evil, and it disappears. Well, they reason in the kind of Jesuitical way that God allows evil to exist to test human soul. You give in to the temptation, you go to hell. You resist the temptation, you go to heaven. But because Satan came back and corrupted Adam and Eve, God said, the devil can no longer work his evil directly on people. Well, the devil is shrewd. So the devil finds witches, people he sleeps with, and so he corrupts them, they corrupt us. So what these authors said was, why don't we have a WID program, Witch Identification Destruction, where we identify the witches, get them to confess, and destroy them. And if you do that, you break the link between the devil and people, and evil will cease to exist. Interestingly, as you see in this picture, or if I ask you which, what's the first gender that comes to mind? We always think witches. You don't think witch as a man. And in fact, most of the people who were tortured, most people who suffered were witches. There are a number of books that argue that this started the legacy of violence against women, which exists through today, because it was the church and the state identifying the men in the church and state identifying women as the enemy. So the Lucifer effect is really the most extreme cosmic transformation of God's favorite angel into the devil, into Satan. And the reason I focus on that is it sets the context for me for investigating lesser transformation of just good people, not angelic, to do bad things, not devilish things, in certain times, in certain situations. So my psychological definition of evil is the exercise of power, and that's going to be the key, to intentionally harm psychologically through prejudice, dehumanization, to hurt physically through torture, and or to destroy mortally or spiritually destroy a religion through genocide, whole peoples. A simple definition is evil is knowing better and doing worse. But why are we fascinated with evil? And that soon when I finish this, then we'll get into a case study. We'll look at evil in action. I think it's because of the power. It's the power of someone or some agency, some agent or agency, to control and dominate other people, animals, or nature. And especially fascinating when it's creative, unique, absolute, and raw. We're less interested in the bad consequence that 3,000 people died in 9/11. What we could not take our eyes off was the planes crashing into the World Trade Center, cutting it in half and then having it evaporate. That's something nobody had ever seen. It's the most, in one sense, it's the most extreme form of power. And it was creative, weaponizing a commercial airline and destroying 210-story buildings. And so, yeah, 3,000 people died, unless one of those people you knew personally. That was not the fascination. It was with the creative, absolute use of power. If you Google evil, a word so empty that it surely should have withered away by now, up come 136 million hits in a third of a second. Tony Blair swore to confront evil where we found it. George W. Bush would be lost without the word. His name is co-googled with it more than 2 million times. Both men, indeed all politicians, social commenters should read this book, my book. This was an editorial in the London Times back in April. In fact, George Bush recently said, "It makes me realize the nature of the enemy we face, which hardens my resolve to protect the American people. People who do that kind of thing, it's not a civil war, it's pure evil. I believe we had an obligation to protect ourselves from that evil." Well, of course, if you identify others as evil, reciprocally, that automatically makes you good. You are the defender. You are the protector of the society, of the nation, of your family against the bad guys. But it's also part of something we all do. Is we erect a boundary which we think is impermeable. And bad people are there and we're here. We are kind, our kin are on the good side, and they are on the bad side. And we live with the illusion that they cannot ever become good and we cannot ever become bad. So part of my goal today is to dispel you of that illusion, to make you think at the end, maybe I too could go across that boundary at some time, at some place. So the Lucifer effect is really a celebration of the human mind's infinite capacity to make us behave as kind or cruel, caring or indifferent, creative or destructive. And it makes some of us villains, but it also makes others heroes. And I'm going to end with a positive note on how do we create the heroic imagination in our families and our children in the next generation. So the Lucifer effect, the whole focus of the book is, it challenges, it asks you, how well do you really know yourself? How sure are you what you would or would not do in a totally new situation? And I'm going to argue, you don't know anything about yourself if you don't put yourself in a new situation, because what you know about yourself today is what you know from yesterday. And all of us arrange our life to always be in the same familiar situations. We rarely are in really new situations, and that's where we get tested. And so in the research I'm going to present to you, we do just that. We take ordinary people and put them in a totally new situation, as Abu Ghraib was, as the Stanford Prison Experiment was. And the question is, how well does anybody really know you? And how well do you know anybody else? Think of the people you know best, your wife, your family. You know a small slice of life, a few hours a day, if that much. And you know them playing a particular role. And they know you playing a particular role. And so this is one of the challenges to say, when we hear about the high school shootings, everybody says, how could it be? I knew him really well. He was a Boy Scout. He never said no to his mother. He was a good little kid. And now he chopped up his mother, you know, and ate his grandmother. We thought we knew him well, Horatio, but we didn't. So let's begin with a case study of evil in action. I call this digitally documented depravity. These came from the cameras of United States soldiers stationed in Abu Ghraib. In a particular place, all the abuses took place in Tier 1A. That was the hard site in Abu Ghraib prison. And it all took place on the night shift. Night shift was 4 p.m. to 4 a.m. And what you're going to see is the evil begins, as all evil begins, with a small first step. They're getting them to do push-ups. They're getting them to punish while they're doing push-ups. They push them around. They hit them. And then it escalates. And one of the reasons for evil in many prison-like situations, one of the motivations, is boredom. When you get bored, the way you break through boredom is to think of something to do which is novel, which is fun, which is playful. And if all you have are people as your objects, and you don't have other things, then people become the objects that you're going to use to break through your boredom. Here's Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. And this is Brigadier General Janice Karpinski. She was supposed to be in charge of that unit. She never visited it. That's one of the reasons some of those abuses occurred. And they want to know, who are the bad apples? Who's responsible for those abuses? The problem is, if you frame the question of who is responsible, there's only one answer. It's people. I want to frame the question a different way. If you ask the question, what is to blame? It could be people, but it could be something more. And obviously, the something more is what I'm going to present as a social psychologist is, what is to blame, we're going to see, is the situation that corrupted those young men and women, military policemen. So how do psychologists go about trying to understand the psychological dynamics of such transformations of human character? Well, if they were always bad, it's not a transformation. They're bad and they did bad. I'm arguing, let's assume, for the sake of argument, that they start off as good, and suddenly, in a short time, they're doing these kinds of things, and worse. The traditional way that psychologists explain any human behavior, that most psychologists, all psychiatrists, clinical psychologists, people in assessment, cognitive psychologists, is the same as in religion, is the same as in medicine. We look for pathologies in the person, within the person, with defective character structures, sadistic personalities, the bad apples. Social psychologists and other social scientists say, of course, individuals are always the actors, but we have to understand the stage. We have to understand the behavioral context. We have to understand who's the stage director. We have to understand whether the behavior is alone or in an ensemble, whether it's improvised or scripted. So here it says maybe there were good men and women corrupted by the behavioral context, and we're going to talk about what that really means, by powerful situational forces, and that's where the bad barrel comes in. One of the things I did in going through these investigative reports is I moved beyond, my focus was always just on the situation. I began to ask the question about what is the system that creates those situations? And the system is the legal, historical, cultural, economic forces that maintain such situations. And this is where the real power is. So here's the power. The power creates those, and then this is a secondary power that can corrupt good people. So the Lucifer effect involves understanding human character transformation when ordinary good people become perpetrators of evil. And it's through the interplay of these three forces, things that people bring into the situation, things that the situation brings out of people, how they interact, the person in the situation, and in fact, then we have to understand those in dominant systems that create and maintain those situations. Here's a wonderful cartoon, a recent New Yorker cartoon. I'm neither a good cop nor a bad cop, Jerome. Like yourself, I'm a complex amalgam of positive and negative personality traits that emerge or not, depending on circumstances. So this is really what my talk is going to be all about. Many of you remember the Robert Louis Stevenson famous story, parable about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, that the good Dr. Jekyll invents some chemical. When he takes it, he is transformed into the evil Mr. Hyde. And when the drug wears off, he becomes a good guy again. But he can't resist trying it just one more time, especially since there's no human subjects committee he has to go through. He's his own subject. And he goes back and forth. And even as a kid, I always wondered, I said, wait a minute, I thought that boundary was permeable. But Robert Louis Stevenson's story, the real central theme is it's permeable. Like, you know, like our cells of our body, which are generally impermeable, but do allow transfers of chemical. So social psychological research, I think, can answer questions of how Dr. Jekyll can be transformed into Mr. Hyde without drugs. And I think it also can help us answer the question of how once good army soldiers playing the role of military police. That's not who they are. It's a role they play in a far-off land, in a far-off prison, in a very controversial war, how they were transformed into perpetrators of evil, as you have seen. Let's see. So it all begins with a study. I'm only going to be able to, in a short time, present a few social psychological studies that demonstrate the power of the situation. The most dramatic one some of you have heard about, but probably few really know the details of, and I'll try to go through very quickly. It's a study done by Stanley Milgram, back at Yale University in the 1960s. And this study is the most representative and generalizable in all of psychology because he utilized 1,000 ordinary citizens from New Haven, Connecticut and Bridgeport, Connecticut. They started by answering this ad. And the ad says, we're going to pay you to be in a study of human memory. It tells you why it's important for psychologists to study memory. And it says, we don't want college students or high school students. We want ordinary people, factory workers, businessmen, professional people, construction workers, white-collar workers, whatever. So you read the ad and you say, well, $4 is not so good, but, you know, I want to help science. And you go down. And there are two people there. One of you is going to be a teacher. One of you is going to be a learner. So you're going to play good roles. The experiment is in the white lab coat. And he tells you that there's no research done on whether punishing errors will help improve memory, as well as rewarding right answers we know will improve learning and memory. So that's what we're going to do. The teacher is going to give the learner something to learn. When the learner gets it right, you reward him. When the learner gets it wrong, you punish him. And we do this until the learner learns it and gets it all right. So here's the learner being hooked up into a kind of electric chair. Here's the teacher being told what the apparatus does. And before you is a box with 30 switches. The first switch is 15 volts. He doesn't even feel it. And each successive switch increases just by 30 volts, so 15, 45, etc. When it starts off, the guy is doing well, and then he starts dumbing down and making errors and errors, and you're shocking more and more. He's in the other room. You're in the room with the experiment, and the guy starts screaming. And you're a good person. You turn to the experiment and say, sir, who's going to be responsible if something happens? The experiment tells you, I'll be responsible. Continue. And it goes on, and the guy's screaming more and more. I got a heart condition. And again, those 1,000 people are mostly good people, and they don't want to go on. But the experimenter now switches from being a caring, just person to being this authoritarian Nazi. You must go on. You have a verbal contract. And whatever you say, you're not getting out of that situation. So the question is, it now gets up to 375 volts, danger, severe shock. The guy screams, and there's silence. And you say, sir, something's wrong. Somebody should go and see him. experiment says, we'll see him when the experiment's over. You continue to shock. And the system goes up to 450 volts, triple X, the pornography of power. And the question is, would anybody go all the way? Well, Milgram asked 40 psychiatrists what their estimate was. And they said only 1% of American citizens would go all the way to 450 volts because that's sadistic behavior and only sadists would engage in it. They are guilty of the dispositional error because psychiatrists believe everything is in the person. They ignored the authority, the roles, the contract, the situation, etc. And they make what we call the fundamental attribution error. It's what we all make. That is, we tend to overestimate the contribution of personality, and we underestimate the contribution of situations where we're trying to understand any behavior. Here's the data, very simply, of one study. This is the number of people who drop out, and this is the shock level, from 15 up to 450. Nobody drops out to 285 volts. The guy's been screaming all along. And at that point, six people drop out. Here's 375. The guy screams silent. How could you be helping him improve his memory? He's dead, or he's unconscious. So at that point, you quit. Doesn't make sense. But now you're under the control of this experiment who say, you must go on. And in fact, not 1%, two-thirds, 65% of the people go all the way. So psychiatrists could not be more wrong. Well, this is only one study. I said he ran a thousand participants. He actually did 16 different experiments. And what you show is this is the percent going all the way. You can go from 90% down to almost zero. And not by putting good people or bad people in or out. In each experiment, he varies one situational variable. Well, what about women? Women as participants, 13. Same as men, 60%. How do you get 16%? How do you get 90%? If you see somebody like you go all the way, you know what? That social model influences you and you go all the way. In study five, if you see people like you resist, then you resist. So people present powerful social models of compliance or rebellion, and those models can influence your behavior. But what Milgram shows, this is like putting a dial into human nature. You can dial up obedience from zero, almost nobody does it, all the way up to 90%. But in most studies, it was that same level, about two-thirds. All research is artificial, obviously. You're never in your life going to be sitting in front of a box pressing buttons and so forth. So you always want to say, what are the real-world parallels? Well, 912 American citizens, many from San Francisco, most in Los Angeles, from our neighborhood, committed suicide or were killed by their family and friends in the jungles of Guyana following the commands of a minister, Reverend Jim Jones. He was a minister of something called People's Temple in November 1978. Big temple in San Francisco, actually down the street from where the Fillmore is. And if you go online, you can listen to that speech. He gives a speech encouraging them to commit revolutionary suicide. But he had brainwashed them. He brought them under mind control over several years. So this was just the end product of blind obedience to authority. In the long and gloomy history of mankind, there have been more crimes committed in the name of obedience than in the name of disobedience. So God was wrong by punishing Lucifer and not going through some conflict resolution. Well, while Milgram, who was my high school classmate, by the way, in Monroe High School in the Bronx, while he was doing that, I was reading Goulding's Lord of the Flies. And as you remember, the key in Goulding's Lord of the Flies is one of the boys changes his external appearance, takes his clothes off, paints himself. Then a previously inhibited behavior, killing animals, wild pigs that they needed for food, gets disinhibited, and now they can kill the pig. Once barriers against killing are dropped, then they can also kill other kids, and they start killing. They kill the intellectual boy Piggy, and so the question is that psychologically valid? That's a novel. So I did an. So social psychologists say, well, let's see. Let's do an experiment. And what we do is women from my class at New York University come to lab. We're going to make them anonymous. There's my assistant, Scott Frazier. He gives them a cover story, a big lie about they're in an experiment where other women are trying to be creative under stress. The other women are going to be creative. Your job is to give them stress. But we don't want them to pick up nonverbal cues. And you're going to be in a group of four women, And we're eliminating all nonverbal cues by putting these hoods over your head, putting on big floppy lab coats. You listen to tape recordings of the two different women you're going to meet. We give you a sample of the shock, and the shock is very painful. And the measure is not shock intensity increase as in Milgram, it's duration. How long do you hold your finger down on that button? Again, what you always got to ask in an experiment, what is compared to what? What is the comparison group? What is the control group? In this case, it's women from the same group treated exactly the same with one exception. Instead of taking their individuality away, we emphasize it. But everything else is, and they're randomly assigned to that condition versus the, what we call de-individuation condition. So here I am behind the screen with the first of the two victims. A light goes on, you put your finger on the button, another light goes on, shock is in the system. You believe it because she's twisting and turning and moaning and complaining. As in the Milgram study, they are actus. They are confederates. They do not actually get punished, but it's so realistic that people believe it. So here's the data. This is the amount of shock. This is the first 10 trials and the second 10 trials. If you are individuated, you start at a low level, and you stay there. But we're interested in what is the effects of anonymity. In the de-individuated condition, you start at twice as high, and over time you shock more and more and more. We've done this study with masks. We've done this study throwing styrofoam balls rather than shock. And you always get the same effect. Anything that makes you anonymous in a situation that gives you permission to be aggressive, to be violent, will enhance that tendency. And the second thing is, once you get into shocking, once you get into hurting other people, it becomes self-reinforcing. And it increases more and more over time. It's kind of like a shark feeding frenzy. Does it make a significant difference? Again, we're going to go in the real world. If warriors change their appearance before going to battle, again, who cares about college students in hoods shocking other college students? An anthropologist asked this question. Does it make a difference in how they treat their victims if they change their appearance before going to battle or not? Well, we know in many cases they don't. You just go to war. You don't change your appearance. In other cases, you do as in The Lord of the Flies. You paint yourself. You put on masks. And in most civilized nations, we put men in military uniforms. It has the same exact effect. So what effect? What's the difference? If you don't change your appearance... Well, I should say, there are 23 different cultures that he found. Two bits of data. Do they change their appearance or not? There are 8 that don't change, 15 that change. And the measure he's looking at, do they kill, torture, mutilate their victims? Not pressing a button on a shock generator. 13 societies are high on killing, torture, mutilating, 10 are low. So if they don't change their appearance, only 1 of 8 cultures do this. We're interested, obviously, in the red zone. If they change their appearance... Look at this, 90%, 12 of 13 societies that change their appearance are high on torturing, killing, and mutilating. So in fact, that little study in NYU has dramatic parallels in the real world. So it's culture has wisdom. It says if you want young men to kill other young men in war, put it back up, if old men want to send young men to kill other young men in war. That's what all war is about. The only thing that's different is whether it's for turf or for oil or things like this. Then you put them in a uniform. You change their appearance, and it makes it easier for them to do it. Uniform also makes them all behave the same. You take away individuality. But now when the war is over, whether you win or lose, you know what? You have to give the uniform back because we don't want you to come home and be a killer. We want you to go back to being a good little boy. This leads us to the Stanford Prison Experiment, which I did back in 1971. We put an ad in the paper, a little bit like Milgram's, trying to get college students for a study of prison life to run up to 2 weeks. And 75 people volunteered. We gave them personality tests, clinical interviews, and we picked 24 who were the most normal and healthy, and we randomly assigned them, flip of the coin, guard prisoner, guard prisoner, guard prisoner. So that means at time one, we know they're only good apples going to go in our prison, and we know there's no difference between prisoners and guards.
Prisoner 819 did a bad thing. Prisoner 819 did a bad thing. Prisoner 819 did a bad thing.
So this is the paradise at Stanford University. We're going to turn it into a hell very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
unbeknownst to the kids who were going to be prisoners, we said, wait at home or in the dormitory. They didn't know that I had recruited the Palo Alto Police Department to do a very realistic arrest. Because he wanted to take away their freedom. We didn't want them to come and voluntarily give it up. Police car pulls up in front, and a cop comes to the front door, knocks, and says he's looking for me. So they, right there, they took me out the door, they put my hands against the car. It was a real cop car, it was a real policeman, and there were real neighbors in the street who didn't know that I was, this was an experiment. And there was cameras all around and neighbors all around. They put me in the car, then they drove me around Palo Alto. They took me to the police station, the basement of the police station. Then they put me in a cell. I was the first one to be picked up, so they put me in a cell, which is just like a room with a door with bars on it. You could tell it wasn't a real jail. They locked me in there in this degrading little outfit. They were taking this experiment too seriously.
Well, indeed we were. This is what one of the guards looked like. The guards had military uniforms, symbols of power, and also silver reflecting sunglasses, an idea I got from the movie Cool Hand Luke with Paul Newman. If you haven't seen it, you should see it. It's a classic. We put them in an anonymous yard. We converted a basement of Stanford Psychology Department into a prison yard. Prisoners went through degradation rituals, as most prisoners do, also in military boot camp. Stripping them naked, bags over the heads. The prisoners were put in essentially dresses with numbers on. They became their number. They gave up the name. So total de-individuation. This is the yard in action. There's solitary confinement, the hole. And again, as you saw in the Abu Ghraib picture, it starts with push-ups, jumping jacks, simple things. And over time, it gets more and more boring. Guards work 8-hour shifts and go home. Prisoners live there 24/7. There were three prisoners and three guards. There were nine prisoners and three guards on any one shift, and the guards rotated through three shifts. Over time, the abuse escalated, having them do more and more humiliating things, cleaning out toilet bowls with their bare hands, stripping them naked, sexual humiliation, and finally sexually degrading activities, including simulated sodomy. Here's hooded prisoners awaiting the parole board hearing with their legs chained together with the bags over their heads. That kid you saw who was the first to get arrested, he was the first to break down. Normal, healthy kid, chosen 3 days, 36 hours earlier. He's now having an emotional breakdown. And each day thereafter, another student broke down in a similar way. We could just call it extreme stress reaction. And so we had to end the study. We couldn't go... We ended it after 6 days because it was out of control. The guards were stepping up their psychological abuse. I limited only physical abuse, but the guards were stepping up psychological abuse to the extent that five of the prisoners had emotional breakdowns. I have a wonderful website I recommend to you, LuciferEffect.com, which has everything about the book, about the experiment, about it's going to be a popular movie, links to, I'm going to talk later about heroism, about resisting influence, about dehumanization. It also gives you a chance to vote, the extent to which George Tenet, former head of the CIA, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, and George Bush are responsible for command complicity in the abuses we are talking about. Again, what are the real-world parallels? Compare this with this. Paper bags are, we're ecologically minded in America, so we substitute those with sandbags. So now we don't use paper anymore. We have prisoners in black sandbags, a chain. This is Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. So, of course, I'm going to see parallels. But James Schlesinger, who was a former Secretary of Defense, he headed one of these investigative reports. And let me just take a minute to say with the parallels that he sees. The potential for abusive treatment of detainees during the global war on terrorism was entirely predictable based on a fundamental understanding of the principles of social psychology, coupled with an awareness of numerous known environmental risk factors. Findings from the field of social psychology suggest that the conditions of war, the dynamics of detainee operations, carry inherent risk for human mistreatment, and therefore must be approached with great caution and careful planning and training. No training, no caution, no careful planning. Psychologists have attempted to understand how and why individuals and groups who usually act humanely can sometimes act otherwise in certain circumstances. That's my Lucifer effect. He hadn't read it because I hadn't written it yet. But he did read, the landmark Stanford study provides a cautionary tale for all military detention operations. This is 35 years old. I mean, who doesn't know the basics of that study? In contrasting the relatively benign environment of the Stanford Prison Experiment, the report makes evident, quote, that in military detention operations, soldiers work under stressful combat conditions that are far from benign. So here's this guy I defended, Chip Frederick. It was his idea to put this guy, putting him on a stress position was a Donald Rumsfeld idea, but to put electrodes on his hand so and make him think that when his legs gave way, he'd fall off and he'd be electrocuted. So he did some bad things. He admitted to them. There's no question about it. You're in the pictures. What was he like before going down to that dungeon? The most all-American patriotic soldier imaginable. He's a poster boy for the military. He loves the American flag. He loves the Star Spangled Banner. He won 9 medals and awards before going down to that dungeon. When he was in Kuwait, the kids loved him. There are pictures of him playing with the kids. He's trying to learn Arabic, even though he has, you know, very limited educational level. A model soldier in every way. So dispositional, very quickly. I have him tested by the Army psychiatrist. Normal on every dimension, no sadistic tendencies. He comes from a small town in Pennsylvania. I said won 9 medals and awards. He had been a good guard in a low security prison. He was a super patriot. What's the situational? Everything we saw in the Stanford Prison Study is there. The dehumanization, de-individuation, moral disengagement. Worst abuses happen in both places on the night shift. He worked 12-hour shifts. 4 p.m. to 4 a.m., 7 days a week, with not a day off for 40 days. He gets one day off and works 2 more weeks. In the most chaotic conditions, the places under bombardment, prisoners and guards are being killed all the time. Prisoners are trying to escape. Electricity goes out. Prisoners are wandering around naked. It's filthy. There's no toilets. There's porta potties that overflow, so there's shit everywhere. There's rats all over. And he's in charge now of 1,000 prisoners, 12 Army reservists, 60 Iraqi police who are smuggling weapons in. And he has no training and no supervision. Not once in 3 months did any senior officer come down to that dungeon. And as I said, extreme fear. Why did it happen in this one place? This was the place where the CIA and military intelligence did their interrogation of high-value detainees, of people they thought were connected to al-Qaeda. And then what happened is when the insurgency started, that our military and our military command had not a clue about, they started arresting whole families, men and women. There were children here as well. And they didn't have any information to give. So the CIA and the military intelligence and civilian interrogators put pressure on these military police, army reservists. They're not real soldiers. They're weekend soldiers. To soften them up, to take the gloves off, to prepare them for interrogation. So they give them the permission to do whatever they wanted to do to soften them up. They just went a little too far, and they took the trophy photos. So who's responsible for creating and maintaining these conditions? Using dogs to induce fear, nakedness of prisoners, extreme stress and fear imposed, sleep, food, sensory deprivation, concealing illegal practice from Red Cross. There were 21 murders in military prisons in Iraq, Cuba, and Afghanistan. Not Chip Frederick or any of those MPs on the night shift. All of these were standard operating procedures that I outlined in my book that came directly from Donald Rumsfeld in a memo of acceptable techniques of interrogation. He brought those to Guantanamo Bay. General Miller put them in practice. General Miller took them to Abu Ghraib and told General Sanchez he had to do it. One of the reports is by a General, Fay. He says, the system is guilty. For a period of 7 months, military intelligence personnel allegedly requested, encouraged, condoned, or solicited military police personnel, or they participate in detainee abuse themselves, or they established established procedures. The abuses would not have occurred had military doctrine been followed and mission training conducted. It was the environment created Abu Ghraib that contributed to the occurrence of such abuse, and the fact that it remained undiscovered by higher authorities for a long period of time. Who was watching the story? It was not one day. It was months and months that these things went on. General Fay and General Jones get together on their report. They say there are 7 factors leading to this abuse. Only one was dispositional. The character structure of these soldiers, 6 are situational or systemic. They say, looking beyond personal responsibility, leader responsibility, command responsibility, systemic problems and issues also contributed to the volatile environment in which abuse occurred. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was himself a prisoner in Gulag's Stalin's Gulag Archipelago, says, the line between good and evil cuts through the center of every human heart, of every human being. So I'm going to quickly, in the last 5 minutes, switch to a positive thing. The last chapter of my book, I give advice, how do you resist these kinds of influences? Because not everybody does them. Even if it's 90%, there's 10% who resist. And also, it's a celebration of heroism. The reason those abuses came to light was because this ordinary Army reservist, Joe Darby, saw the pictures you saw, and he said, this is terrible. We're supposed to be bringing democracy to these people. We're bringing degradation, humiliation. So he took that CD and he gave it to an investigative officer, and that was an enormous act of courage, because Army Reserve is like the lowest level of military life, and he's taking this knowing that he's going to get his buddies in trouble. And he does it because he said it's the right thing to do. In fact, they had to put him, his mother, and his wife in protective custody for 3 years because everybody wanted to kill him. Not just the soldiers in the unit, but people in his hometown, because they said he humiliated the Bush administration and the military. The messenger, not the people that he had exposed. We all saw this famous picture of a Chinese student who heroically challenged the government forces after the student rebellion in Tiananmen Square. He went in front of a row of tanks that were heading to crush that rebellion. And he started screaming, saying, you know, we're all Chinese. All we want is freedom. Don't hurt us. And the row of tanks turned around and went away. So he's a physical hero. Joe Darby, I'm going to call him a really more social hero. The banality of evil, Hannah Arendt's famous concept, is that people who do evil don't look like monsters, they look like us. And that's what's really scary. It's the terrifying normality of people. She's saying Adolf Eichmann, who orchestrated the deaths of millions of Jews before going into Auschwitz and after, is normal. Everything about him, everything is... But you put him in that situation, he's now transformed. I argue that there's a banality of heroism, that heroes are not extraordinary people. Heroes are ordinary people who do an extraordinary deed. And so I demystify what it means to be a hero. And so the same exact situation that inflames the hostile imagination in some people will inspire the heroic imagination in others, while rendering most people passive. What do I mean? The psychology of heroism is, how do we encourage, and this may be a Google project, children, families, everyone, to develop a heroic imagination, to think of yourself as a hero in waiting for some situation to come along that will provide a catalyst for action on behalf of other people or for defending an ideal. To be a hero requires only 2 things. That you act when other people are not. You can't be a hero without doing something. In fact, you got to go against your mother's prescription. Don't get involved, mind your own business. Mama, humanity is my business. You know, you're wrong. And you have to stop being egocentric and be sociocentric. I want to end with this very moving video clip. Some of you have heard about it. I don't know if you've seen it. A few months ago in New York City, on a train station, a subway station, some guy gets a seizure and he falls across the track and the subway is coming. He's going to cut him in half. There are 76 people on that station. 75 freeze and do nothing. One of them is an African-American construction worker, Wesley Autry, 50 years old. He's got a reason not to do anything. He's got his 2 little kids with him. He gives them to a stranger, says, take care of them. He's black. The other guy's white. He jumps down on that platform, and he says, I did what anyone could do. Didn't take special ability to jump down, but I did what everyone ought to do. And that's really a mantra of ordinary heroes. And then we'll end right after this. We're open for questions.
On the New York City subway, it's hard enough finding someone who will give up his seat to a stranger, let alone be willing to give up his life for one.
The train was coming in like that.
It happened just...
Yeah.
50-year-old Wesley Autry, a construction worker and Navy veteran, was standing on a subway platform with his two little girls when right in front of them, a man started having a seizure.
He kind of stumbled over his own feet and fall backwards. I see a train coming, but the train is so close, I'm like, what do I do?
Wesley jumped onto the tracks and thought if he could just lie on top of the man, keep him from flailing, maybe the train would roll right over both of them. The clearance was exactly 21 inches. Wesley and the man, 20 and a half.
No way the train can stop before this gentleman could get him up off the tracks. So he covered him with his body and pushed him down to a point where the train wouldn't hit his head and held him down under the tracks while the train came and rolled right over the top of him.
It gave Wesley's children the scare of their young lives.
I thought he was going to get killed.
And Wesley, the scare of his, too.
I'm like talking to him, sir, you can't move. I got two kids up here looking for the father to come back. I don't know you, you don't know me, but listen, don't panic. You know, I'm here to save you.
As for the guy Wesley saved, he's 20-year-old Cameron Hollipter. And other than a few scrapes and bruises, his father says he's doing fine.
Mr. Autry's instinctive and unselfish act saved our son's life.
You know, the word hero gets thrown around a lot nowadays.
What a better way to say it to start off the new year than to save a life.
Nice to be reminded of what one really looks like. Steve Hart.
So one day, you will be in a new situation that there are three paths before you. One of those paths, people are going to be doing bad shit. Lying, cheating, cursing, telling racist, sexist jokes. If you're in school, kid, teasing, bullying, and you're going to join in because you want to be one of the guys, one of the team. The second path is you become guilty of the evil of passive inaction. Most people do nothing. You look, you see, you look the other way. It's awkward. Every time you get in a taxi cab in New York and the guy starts telling you a racist, sexist joke, you just, you know, say, I don't want to hear this. You don't tell him, or when your Uncle Charlie does. The third path is you go straight ahead and become a hero. And you become a hero by taking action to stop the evil. We know in psychology that if we get you to think of yourself as a generous person, that next time there's a blood drive, next time there's a charity drive, you're more likely to give blood and donate to charity. If we get you to think that you're not the kind of person who litters, next time you're about to throw something on the ground, you put it in your pocket. I think the same thing is true about heroism. If we can get young people to think that heroes are not special people. You don't have to be more compassionate, more altruistic. You don't have to be a Quaker. You don't have to have a special religious background. What you have to do is have compassion for others and act when other people are acting badly or not acting at all. And stop being concerned about yourself, your self-interest, your egocentrism. Because ordinary heroes are waiting for the right situation to put our heroic imagination into action. And you know what? That situation is going to come once in your life. Almost nobody is a two-time hero. And if the situation comes and you let it go by, you've lost your chance to become a hero. So we want to figure out how can we develop curriculum for school kids to promote, celebrate heroism. So I thank you for your attention. And the end note is oppose injustice, immorality, incompetence, entitlement, and personal power fascist governments at home and abroad. Thank you very much.
You're listening to a talk by Professor Philip Zimbardo on the Lucifer Effect, given to an audience of Google employees as part of their author series. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We return to the conclusion of Zimbardo's presentation as he answers questions from the audience.
We have time for questions.
Actually got two things. This first off, I was curious if you'd seen the follow-up article on the Subway Hero in New York Magazine, I think it was.
No, I haven't seen.
He was sort of used terribly by people around him. I'll send you a link if I can find it again.
Used in what way?
People tried to take advantage of him, sign him up for things and take money away. And
yeah, I mean, it's very hard to be a hero.
His life was not significantly better afterwards, was the gist of it.
The big problem is, and this you got to have how we work this into the curriculum, most people, whistleblowers, suffer. That whistleblowers, usually are scorned, by the corporation that you're exposing the fraud in. I'm saying, here's Joe Darby who exposed this thing. If he had not been put in protective custody, he might have lost his life. So you have to be willing. I mean, to be a hero means you're making a sacrifice of time, of reputation, not just your life. See, I would like that. Send me that.
And the other factor is I like to think of myself as being in the hero class, and I have had some fairly minor incidents come up, which I think contribute to that. One thing I think may have done that was I grew up reading and still do a lot of superhero comic books. Uh-huh. But on the other hand, I've noticed things like even in a minor situation, like I was in a marching band, someone runs up, swipes the drum major's hat, which he had paid for himself. Right. The band knew this. The guy was well-liked. I was the only one who took off after him out of 150 people.
Right.
So I really don't think you're stressing the ordinary heroism. I don't think it's that ordinary. I keep seeing situations where, as you say, it's mostly people being very passive. So I think there is something extraordinary in the people who do go out and make those efforts.
No, my point is that the heroic act is always extraordinary because most people are not doing it. But I don't want it to be that the hero is a special person and that if you don't have the hero gene, you're not going to do this. I'm saying anybody could do this. Some people, let me put it this way. There is Nelson Mandela, there's Martin Luther King, there's Mother Teresa. There are people who organize their life around sacrifice, heroic. They are the exception in the same way that evil dictators are the exception. Most people who do evil do it once, do it in Abu Ghraib, do it in some other situation, do it as guards in the Stanford Prison Study. But I'm saying, so the important thing is, how do you develop a curriculum where kids begin to think about, what have I done that's heroic in my life in the last week? Who in my family, who in my friends have done something heroic? Just begin to think about heroism in our culture. We have I just developed a developing website, Everyday Heroes. But it's really saying the best antidote to evil is having a culture, society, that has a lot of heroes waiting to oppose evil. Other comments, questions?
So,
yes.
So very quick, the sort of...
I know you have to leave it whenever it's time, it's okay.
The anthropological study and data about the uniform effect and mutilation. I mean, there's too many potential confounding variables. Well, there's a lot of people in the military, and a lot of them probably commit violent crimes in their normal country when they're not on duty in war or whatever, and some fraction of them wear their uniforms around. I mean, have people looked at is the probability of committing a violent crime of a soldier in their normal off-duty culture higher during those times when they're wearing their uniforms? I mean, they wear their uniforms around a lot. They don't wear their uniforms around sometimes, and there's probably enough data about how often they commit violent crimes.
Nobody's looked at that. I mean, the anthropological study, of course, has confoundings. For me, it's just impressive to say if you look across 23 different cultures, you get this very dramatic effect of 90% versus 10%. But essentially, the idea would be that simply the whole purpose of being in a soldier in the infantry or the Marines is to make you a killer. That's the point. That when somebody says shoot, you shoot. You don't think. Just like the Milgram study, when somebody says press the button, you press the button, you don't think. It doesn't make sense. The guy's unconscious. Press the button, you press the button. Shoot, you shoot. You have to be a killer. That's what the training is. But in fact, we want you to be a killer in a situationally specific environment called war, and only when somebody is the enemy. Now, the problem is you come back having done that, and you've lowered threshold against aggressive behavior, and it becomes highly likely that you're going to be aggressive toward your spouse or your friends. And it's part of the PTSD syndrome, a big aggressive component.